a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us, everyone in the room and everyone on the phone. We're glad that you're with us this morning. I'm Kelsey Pritchard with the Governor's Office, and just a reminder, everyone in the room, to please use the microphones at the table during the Q&A portion, and also everyone on the phone, you can mute your lines by pressing *6 and unmute by pressing #6. With the governor today, we have Senator Deb Soholt, Senator Jenna Hager, Representative Peggy Gibson, and Senator Alan Solano. And with that, I'll turn it over to Governor Dennis Duhard.
Thank you, Kelsey, and thank you, everyone, for joining in the conference call, or for some of you that are present here, thank you for being here. Next week is the final week of the legislative session, accepting veto day. And I'd like to take this opportunity to reflect a little bit on that. I think it's been a good session. The two houses, I think, have worked together fairly well. We've had good bipartisan support for many legislative proposals. The legislature has supported numerous bills to eliminate unnecessary and outdated statutes, and I'm grateful for that. We've updated our contagious disease law, which was in need of modernization. We've adopted legislation to prohibit self-dealing by state officers and state employees, passed a resolution for a convention to consider a balanced budget amendment to the United States Constitution. We passed a resolution to place before the voters an amendment to the South Dakota Constitution to clarify the governance of our technical institutes. We passed legislation authorizing significant investment in Custer State Park. We strengthened our state's financial practices to limit borrowing by the Building Authority and borrowing by the Health and Ed Authority, and also to codify practices that undertake now a five-year capital expenditure plan, as well as five-year budget reflection and forecasting. One issue that has seen bipartisan support also this year is Jolene's Law Task Force, formed last year to combat child sexual abuse. And I know some legislators were concerned about the legislature's ability to support this task force for a second year. But in my estimation, this work is too important. And I've heard that from many in the past couple of days who urge that it continue. So toward that end, I'm announcing today that the executive branch will partner with the task force members to continue this important work for a second year. And I admire the dedication that the four legislators that are seated here with me have shown. And Deb Soholt has been a great leader on this issue. And I'd like to call on her right now for her comments. Senator Soholt.
Thank you so much, Governor. And as chair of Jolene's task force and the prime sponsor of the bills in the past 2 years to continue this work in child sexual abuse, I just want to say a heartfelt thanks to the governor for his willingness to have us partner with the Department of Health so that we can continue this very meaningful work. You know, it's estimated that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will experience sexual abuse before the age of 18. And as a task force over this past year, we have come to understand the very serious consequences, not only to the child, their mental health, but also their physical health and what happens to the family unit and their ability to be successful in the world. And what we came to understand is that it's not only possible, but highly probable that with further work in this task force that we can really change the landscape of child sexual abuse forever. And we came to see 5 major priorities in looking at increasing our expansion and understanding of our mandatory reporters, that if you look at all the people who are mandatory reporters, that they can really change the world in child advocacy, and that we need to know more and understand more, that we need to have a comprehensive prevention campaign to help family units be able to talk to their children about when they feel unsafe and then to tell somebody about it, to increase our access for children that have experienced it so that we have a streamlined system that's available to all corners of our state, that we would look at true and real prevention measures in this area, not leaving it up to a child to experience it and then to tell. And that we would do a lot of work with mental health, with our counselors, with our medical systems, so that we would more clearly identify and be able to support children that have experienced this. And that if we can work very hard in this area over this next year, and we're so excited to be able to have the funding and the support to be able to do that, that we believe that we can open up this very difficult conversation, and that all of these children, 80% who never tell anyone, that their voices will be silent no more.
Thank you. I think what I'd like to do now is pause and see if there's any questions about this particular issue before going on with a few other things I'd like to talk about.
So why don't we start in the room if there are any questions? James?
Can you just explain logistically how it's going to work, where the money is going to come from? I thought I heard the Department of Health, and how much money it is.
Yes, and maybe Senator Sohol has had more conversations with our Secretary of Health about this and can be more detailed. But I first became aware that we had received some grant funding in excess of what we had expected to receive in the Department of Health. And there was a grantee that had been identified as a subgrantee, the Network Against Family Violence and Sexual Assault. And certainly this is an arena in which they are dealing every day. And so the conversation with the Secretary of Health was, in light of the legislative issue dying, would I be opposed or would I support encouraging some of this grant money, a portion of which was a bit unexpected, to help further the work of the task force? And I said, by all means, let's do this. And this literally came together in the last week. It was unexpected funding, or at least certainly I was made aware of it in the last week. A lot of things happen in government. I'd like to say I know it all, but it doesn't always work quite that way. And Senator, maybe you have some more to add.
Certainly. In the first year of our task force, we actually had $21,000 that was budgeted for our work. We spent $13,000 in coming together over five meetings. So in our request in this next year, we were looking at another $21,000 and wanting to use that as judiciously as possible. We think when we start to really explore some of these areas where now we're going to set targets for South Dakota and then develop the infrastructure to actually attain those, some of these goals would take us 5, 10, 15 years. So we need to get very clear on our targets and then determine the long-term sustainability funding. So what we are looking at, the details have not all been completely worked out, as the governor spoke to. It looks as though we will be doing a partnership under this grant. And then also perhaps through the LRC, there is a little bit of funding left over from our last year that was appropriated. What I want to say about the task force, though, is it's the right people around the table. That we have brought legislators who sit before you right now that are incredibly committed to this work. But we also, from the beginning, involved the executive branch through the Department of Education, Department of Health, Department of Social Services, but also the professionals in the field. So we've had child abuse pediatrician, mental health, counseling, a DCI agent. And through the synergy of that group, and also not to forget Jolene Letcher, who has been so courageous to put her name and face on this issue as having experienced this herself. So that group, we have come a long way together in understanding and depth of knowledge on this issue. So I feel very confident that by continuing our work, we're going to be able to have some very tangible outcomes that the state of South Dakota will be very proud of.
Well, and since we're gathered all here today, I was curious, Governor, and anyone else who'd like to answer, what do you think of the legislature's decision to end the task force, the House State Affairs Committee?
Well, I'll speak to it. I think it's not unusual to have the very debate that was had in the second house, where there's a concern that the legislature, not through a statute or through a bill, direct the Legislative Research Council to undertake a particular study. Every year, the Legislative Research Council receives recommendations from all their members and from committees about studies that should be undertaken, and they have to prioritize those and choose them. That being said, it is not that unusual for a statute to direct a study be done. So you'll see bills that do this. You'll hear arguments against it, which are not unreasonable arguments, but you'll still see it happen. So it really, there's no consistency in the way the legislature has handled this in the past, and that's not a fault. It's just the nature of decision making evolving as it sometimes evolves.
Any other questions in the room? on Jolene's task force?
Just a follow-up to the funding. So it sounds like it'll be around still the $21,000 for this year, or?
Yes, thank you for the question. We believe that we will not have to expend over $21,000 to accomplish the rest of our work that we have targeted to do. And online on the LRC website within the interim committee of Jolene's Law Task Force, there is a final report that we submitted at the beginning of January that fully outlines where we intend to go in the future. So we were looking at the top end of trying to provide support to have that happen. We do believe that we'll probably be expending some dollars within that $21,000 this year in bringing in experts to speak to certain areas that we would really like to determine benchmark best practice so that we can, as we set our targets, that we're not shooting too low. We want to be sure that we are really moving the bar on this, which is something that so totally affects the children of our state. You know, we talked about in committee that if another country was threatening our children, a third of our children, in some meaningful way, we would all be standing up against this and be outraged. With respect to child sexual abuse, something that has gone on, you know, since the beginning of time, it's so easy to say, well, that's somewhere else, that's not in my backyard, I don't have to look at it, that's relegated to child protection services that look at it, that might be only the Department of Social Services. And we have come to understand this issue is a very nature of a public health issue, that this affects the public health of our children. And if we look at it only from the child, their family unit, a single agency, we miss the larger context of how this is a part of how we are as a culture together, and that as a community, we need to link arms and start to protect our children.
Are there any questions on the phone line about Jolene's task force? Okay, well, I know that the senators and representative who joined us this morning are very busy, so if they need to leave, that's fine. But otherwise, Governor, if you want to continue.
And I just, before we leave, I just wanted to publicly thank the governor for his incredible support to this work and for highlighting it within the state of South Dakota. And I think it, you know, really reflects where his priorities are and his good heart. So thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Governor.
Yeah, go ahead. Representative Gibson, go ahead.
Thank you. And I, too, would like to thank the governor for his support on this very important issue. And as I've served on the task force, every place I go to speak about the work of the task force and the writing about it, someone comes up to me and says, well, I was a victim. I was a victim of child sexual abuse. And this is what it did to me. And this is how it impacted my life. And this is what I had to overcome. So it's out there and it's prevalent. 1 in 4 girls, 1 in 6 boys, and that's a horrendous health problem. So I'm very grateful to the governor for extending our wonderful group, dedicated group, to come together and continue our work.
Thank you.
Missing some of your,
Thanks, Jim. In addition to the some of the legislative proposals that have already made their way through the legislature successfully, there are two major initiatives that I mentioned in the state of the state and which are still outstanding, and those, of course, are the juvenile justice reform proposal that our administration offered and highway funding. As for the juvenile justice proposal, I'm very optimistic about juvenile justice reform. The proposal that we offered had unanimous support at the committee level and on the floor in the Senate, and also had unanimous support in the House State Affairs Committee. As they say, it ain't over till it's over, but at the same time, I'm very hopeful Senate Bill 73 will find strong support in the full House when it comes up on the calendar. As for highway funding, the highway funding measure that has been the subject of much discussion, of course, among the legislators, and one version, as you know, has passed the Senate with a two-thirds vote. I'm grateful for the courage of Democrats and Republicans alike who are willing to consider this issue. The House State Affairs, as you know, will consider this issue next week, and I'm hopeful the two bodies will find a version which can gain the two-thirds necessary vote in each House. Time will tell whether that will happen, It's not something I can really make the odds on very well, but I'm hopeful. So we'll see where it goes. Then, of course, as a matter of custom, the last major act of the legislature during recent years legislative session is the General Appropriations Bill, which is considered during the last week of session. This year is a little bit more challenging than the past few years. Nationwide, 17 states, more than a third of the states, are facing budget shortfalls for the year in which we are finding ourselves right now. Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Connecticut, Illinois, Kansas, Louisiana, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Missouri, Nevada, New Jersey, North Dakota, Oklahoma, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. I know each of those states, at the least, are grappling with some problem in the current fiscal year. In South Dakota, our fiscal year begins July 1st, and today we're just over 7 months through our fiscal year 15. Revenue has been soft, and it will not reach the levels appropriated for the current budget year. The good news, though, is that we are spending less than was appropriated, and those savings of less spending are more than the shortfall in revenue. So for the current fiscal year, we are consequently still going to be in the black. Still, a softer revenue picture must cause us to reevaluate the projection of revenue for next fiscal year, for the FY16 fiscal year, which will begin next July. This picture, of course, clarifies with the passing of each month as additional months of revenue history are seen. February revenues were received this week, and both the Bureau of Finance and Management and LRC are adding those numbers to past months and are going to be working today, over the weekend, and looking at revenue projections so that they can give their most up-to-date projection estimate to the Appropriations Committee that will be looking at this very issue next week. Based on their decision of where revenue is likely to fall for fiscal year 16, then we'll have to judge whether the proposed expenditures I offered in the suggested budget last December have to be reduced. And I think it's very possible we may need to do that. Those are the items I wanted to cover before opening up to questions. And, of course, I'm open to questions on any topic whatsoever.
Let's start in the room again if there are any other questions.
As far as revenues or expenditures having to be reduced, I mean, it obviously doesn't sound like a dire situation right now. Can you give me an indication of, you know, really how bad is it?
Sure, sure. Well, let's look at this budget year. The FY15 budget is something less than $1.4 billion. Of course, 10% of that would be $14 million. $140 million, and 1% would be $14 million, and we're going to be short revenue less than that. Right now, probably about $10 million. So in terms of percentage, it's a very small percentage of the gross revenue projection. It's pretty close. It's just on the wrong side of the perfection line. I really hope the legislature will adopt revenues that are conservatively low. And if the revenues come in better than that, then certainly they're available to be spent after they've arrived. What's less happy is when revenue comes in less and we have to cut. Thankfully, the legislature, even though they adopted an estimate that was a little higher than we're seeing actually, they also were conservative on the expense side and conservatively projected expenses at levels that we don't need to spend. And in some areas, it's really not controllable. Certainly, if you look at, for example, the Department of Ag, and they're spending money on salaries or programs, I can say to them, don't spend money. You know, cut back. If you're going to do this or do that, cut back. But then there are some areas where we cannot do that. If a Medicaid eligible person presents themselves for medical treatment, and then that provider presents that bill to the state, we have to pay it. And so, happily, the area of Medicaid is one of those areas where the claims experience has been a little bit lower than we budgeted. And that's an area where we almost always have to budget conservatively high because we can't control it at all. It's just a best guess, and we guess high and hope it comes in below that. And that's been the case so far this year. So FY15 will be all right. Again, we project revenue and expenses here. Revenue is lower, but expenses are still lower than that. And so there is a little bit of gap that will create a surplus. And some of that we can spend in one-time spending right now before the fiscal year ends. We don't want to cut it too close because, again, these are all projections of revenue and expense that we still have several months to have actual experience.
Any other questions in the room?
And can you talk about fiscal year 16 then? What are we seeing?
Yes, fiscal year 16, again, if revenue comes in lower than we thought it would be in December, and it is coming in at a lower level than we thought it would be in December. Of course, we spent the money that we projected we'd receive in revenue. So we're, unless there's some news or some change in one of the revenue sources that reverse that trend, then we're going to have to reduce the expenditure proposals. Now, again, as revenue is lower than we thought it would be in December, expenses continue to trend lower. So it might be that we can move both of them down, and some of the proposals to give, you know, education a certain amount or Medicaid providers a certain amount, we can still attain that. Again, it's all dependent on the revenue estimate, and we want to encourage our appropriators not to stretch for revenue so they can maintain spending at a certain level, but rather to estimate without regard to what the expenditures are. Look at revenue all alone and then make their best judgment where that will be, and then look at where the expenditures are going to be, have to be, to stay within that revenue number.
Go ahead, James.
Do you have any specific things in the fiscal year 16 budget where it would be easier to say, don't do that one anymore in terms of the new spending that you've proposed? Anything that's on the chopping block first?
You know, I would say that a fair number of the discretionary spending proposals that I offered in the December budget are one-time dollars. And the difficulty we're seeing is not in one-time money availability, because we have a fair amount of one-time money. As I said, revenue is lower for this year, but expenditures are still lower, so we've got some one-time money there. Plus, there's a couple of contingency funds that we have maintained for a number of years that we now can extinguish. One is a Medicaid reserve, which our trend down in the Medicaid expenditure level and our increasing ability to project those numbers with better accuracy allows us to spend about $16 million in a Medicaid reserve fund, and that was in the budget proposal. Also, the risk pool, we have high-risk insurance that existed in South Dakota before the Affordable Care Act eliminated the pre-existing condition, the ability of an insurance company to refuse coverage because of a pre-existing condition. We had a high-risk pool to allow those people to get insurance in some cases. Now that insurance is available through the Affordable Care Act and is cheaper there. So we're going to terminate the high-risk pool, and there's about $2 million there, too. So we've got the difference between a lower revenue and a still lower expense as a one-time expenditure source this year. And then we've got these two contingency funds as still two other sources. So collectively, there's a fair amount of money available for one-time uses. What many states will sometimes do is take those one-time dollars and fill an ongoing expense need. But that's very poor discipline, and that is something that we've avoided in South Dakota, and that's one of the reasons why we're not in very bad shape. We have a little bit of difficulty, but it's not significant. It was not severe by any means. We're not going to have to cut anyone. We might have to reduce the amount of increase, but we're not going to have to cut anyone.
Are there any questions on the phone line?
Governor Tony Mangan at KCCR.
Yes, Tony.
Regarding the highway funding bill, are you confident that you will still get a bill this year?
No, I'm not. I think I'm hopeful. I think the likelihood this year is greater than it's ever been, but there's definitely no certainty we'll get a two-thirds vote in both houses on a recipe with the ingredients that both houses like to the degree that they will, in a two-thirds vote, support it. So we'll see. We'll see. I'm hopeful, but I'm definitely not certain.
Governor, has your mindset changed on that? I mean, has something happened in the last few weeks that, and you always said the two-thirds was the challenge, but has your mindset changed that from May you thought you could get a deal to you're not as confident anymore?
Oh, I wouldn't say I'm less confident. I've never been confident. I've always said I'm hopeful, and I'm no less hopeful today than I've been during the legislative process. I think there still is a fair possibility, but a two-thirds vote is a steep climb in both houses, and this is a tax increase, and so many people will be loath to make that vote. But I'm hopeful that the need has been demonstrated and that people will say, well, it's necessary, and responsible legislators meet the necessary functions of government. I believe this is one of the fundamental functions. So that's my belief, that the need is demonstrated. Certainly each legislator will make their own judgment.
Is there one sticking point in your mind?
Oh, I think there's a lot of things in play, but I think they're narrowing, and so we'll see.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the phone line? In the room?
I have a question more in a not concerning this legislative session, but in light of what's going on with the Affordable Care Act, with the Supreme Court case that's going on right now, I know the decision, I believe, is not going to be made until June,
yes.
What do we do if it sounds like only subsidies are for state exchanges? Right. Do you have to call a special session? Are we just not going to do anything? I mean, are you guys thinking about that right now and preparing what the state can do?
Well, there would be two approaches that a state could take. One would be to make up the difference in subsidies that the federal government no longer would be providing. If King versus Burwell is found in favor of the plaintiffs, South Dakota couldn't afford that. We just don't have anywhere near that money. So that would not be realistic. The other would be to create a state-based exchange, and that, depending upon the way the court would rule for the plaintiffs, might be an agreement with the federal government in a different fashion to use their exchange. To create one ourselves would be a multi-year process, probably. I guess I shouldn't say that. I don't know. But it wouldn't be done overnight by any means. So what would happen is you'd revert to pre-Affordable Care Act subsidy situation, where those who were insured through the private sector without subsidy would have to revert to that kind of insurance again. Those who couldn't afford it without subsidy would be back in that boat. And so in the near term, there's just no way that we could prevent the those who lose the subsidy from losing them at all. There certainly would be a period of time where they'd be without it. And again, this assumes that Congress does not have some other fix legislatively, and maybe that'll happen. So we'll see. But it doesn't make sense for the state to start undertaking the creation of a state-based exchange? Because we don't know that. That would be money wasted if the court ruled in favor of the defendants. And we also have looked at the financial viability of such an exchange in the past and decided it's not sustainable in South Dakota on its own merits. It would have to be subsidized by general funds or some new tax or by charges against the participants, and there wouldn't be enough participants to charge the participants. In fact, if you look at the states, there's probably maybe a dozen states or so that have state-based exchanges, and many of them are upside down financially. They're not able, through the assessments against their insureds, or those who are participating in the use of the state-based exchange, there aren't enough of them yet to cover the cost of the exchange. And it's, in some cases, it's because the state's small. Hawaii, for example, is in that situation. They're going to be borrowing. That's their proposal to meet the deficit. Okay, but it's not limited to small states. California is in the same situation. They are not collecting enough money from their participants to pay for the cost of their state-based exchange. So, in short, we would not. It does not make sense to create a state-based exchange in the near term. It's something we could consider, but I'm hopeful that if the court rules in favor of the plaintiffs, that Congress and the president will come together on some fix at the federal level. Although, you know, it's really uncertain what would happen to the Affordable Care Act at all if the court finds in favor of the plaintiffs, because the individual mandate would largely be eviscerated. The small business mandate would be largely eviscerated, and without those income sources, then the financial viability of the Affordable Care Act is very much in question.
Any other questions?
I was just hoping you could talk about your thoughts on the youth minimum wage, Senate Bill 177, and the repeal of the Daschle Law 1176.
Sure. The first question on the youth minimum wage, I haven't decided whether I'll veto that or not. I've been asked about the minimum wage in the past. In that context, there was a question asked of me at one point, would I support legislation to repeal that part that provided for an automatic inflator? And I said no, I thought that would be an affront to the voters. And so to the extent that a direct attack on the bill that was passed in that fashion, you know, I don't support that. This, I can see one could view it differently. The question of whether or not to do something different for minors was not presented to the voters. My guess is that when a voter made their decision about support or not, they were probably looking more at social justice for the adult that needed a higher minimum wage to attain a better standard of living and be able to provide a standard of living. I don't know that they were thinking about the teenager who works sacking groceries or whatever their part-time job is. My kids all have had part-time jobs when they were in high school, and I honestly don't know if they were paid above the minimum wage or not, but it was good for them because it taught them the right kinds of habits that one needs as a worker. You show up on time, you do what your boss says, you look presentable, you're polite to customers, and all those kinds of things. You learn how to follow directions and do all those things that are sort of the soft skills that some workers today don't even have. I haven't decided where I'll come down. I do want to listen to proponent and opponent testimony on that bill that's archived. The other question was, help me.
The Daschle Law.
Oh, the Daschle Law. That bill I will sign. I opposed that bill when I was in the legislature. I voted no on it. And so I'm happy to see a second chance that I can support a bill that would allow us, anytime I think that you can get the opportunity for a South Dakotan to become vice president or president, we should seize that opportunity. And whether that is a Democrat or a Republican, I believed that should be the case when I voted on it in the legislature many years ago, and I still believe it.
Anything else? Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Weekend.